America's space program is scheduled to undergo a fundamental shift in 2011. Unless something changes, by the end of the year, NASA will no longer have a rocket to send astronauts into space. The space shuttle program is being retired, and for the moment, there is no American replacement rocket capable of sending people into orbit. To talk about rockets and more of what's ahead for the new year in space, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca is in the house. And first of all, Joe, how did NASA get into this situation?
Well, as you say, they decided they were going to retire the shuttles, and that makes sense. They're 30 years old. They were an expensive program to operate, and it seemed like after 30 years it might be time to get something new. So NASA began this large program to come up with a replacement, and then the Obama administration decided they didn't want to do that. So they basically canceled the program. Interestingly, the LA Times reports recently that they still have to pay like $500 million in this fiscal year because Congress hasn't gotten around to cutting off the funding yet. But that's another story.
Well, so NASA is abandoning manned spaceflight?
Well, no, they're not. The plan is they've got contracts with the Russian Space Agency to send astronauts to the space station, the International Space Station, on the Soyuz launch system, the capsule, to get astronauts into space. And they've been doing that already. I mean, that's already been an alternative way of getting up there for American astronauts. And the other thing that's happening is there's going to be some private companies that are jumping into this space launch business. SpaceX, Orbital Sciences are some of the ones that have been very public about their activities. There are some others that might be a little more, you know, sort of cagey about what they're up to. But the idea is that NASA will buy launch services from a commercial entity.
But there will be at least two more shuttle flights this coming year.
Yeah, and one of them is one of those exciting supply missions where they bring up lots of equipment. And then the other one is a little more interesting in that it's bringing up a major scientific experiment that's supposed to measure charged particles and cosmic rays. And there could be a third shuttle, and this is one of these funny things. So since the Columbia accident, NASA's policy is to have a space shuttle waiting in case they have to send up a rescue mission if one gets into space and it's been damaged and they don't want to let it come back down to Earth. So they have one that's waiting after the last shuttle mission. But then some people said, well, if it's just waiting there, why don't we launch it? Because it's fully ready to be launched. And so NASA said, well, we will if you tell us to. And right now Congress has said, we're not sure yet. Mm-hmm. So, of course, if they launch that one, then do they have another one standing by? You know, this could go on forever, but I think they're talking about doing one. So it could be three this year, but there's two on the books.
It's always so interesting to talk about human space flight, but there are also some interesting unmanned missions that will be launched in 2011. Can you elaborate on some of them?
Well, sure. One of them that's kind of cool is the Juno spacecraft. That's a solar-powered spacecraft that's heading off to Jupiter. And then there's Grail. It's actually twin spacecraft that are going to be used to determine the interior of our moon, which I think is kind of cool. And then the big one is in Thanksgiving, the next Mars rover is going to go off. It's the Mars Science Laboratory. If you think of the last rovers as sort of like dune buggies, this is more like an SUV, although it's still smaller than an SUV.
Yeah. I remember we talked back in January. It was actually like January 4th, 2004, about the first rover. And that was supposed to last about, a week?
Right. Now, that was the Spirit rover. And a few weeks later, it was the twin rover Opportunity that went up. And they were supposed to last 90 days. So
90 days.
Talk about your successful program. 90 days expected launch. Now we're into 7 years. But I have to say that we might have to declare Spirit dead sometime this year. They had to shut off almost all of its instruments before the winter started because they didn't think they'd have enough power. They're solar powered also. So they shut everything down and they said, when the sun comes back up, we hope to hear from you. Well, the sun's come back up and they haven't heard anything. Now they got some time. It might wake up, but it might not. And that would be sad.
But it's not dead yet.
Well, not officially.
NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks a lot. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Two of hockey's biggest rivals met outdoors last night to play in what some call the Super Bowl of hockey. It may have been rainy and almost balmy at the Bridgestone Winter Classic in Pittsburgh's Heinz Field, but the sold-out event between the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Washington Capitals excited hockey fans everywhere. The Caps ended up winning 3-1. Scott Burnside covers hockey for ESPN.com, and he's on the phone from Pittsburgh. Hey, Scott.
Good morning. How are things?
I want to ask you, did the game live up to its hype?
I mean, it certainly did. This was different from any of the other, the previous three Winter Classics, obviously with the weather. Always a storyline when you take a major sporting event outside, but the first time in the four-year history of the Winter Classic, of course, the start time was pushed back from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. because of persistent rain, and then the rain did fall periodically throughout the game and was quite heavy in the third period, and I think you know, we'll spark some debate about the legitimacy of doing this kind of event and what it means for the game. But all in all, again, and I think another terrific storyline for what has become one of the most important events on the NHL calendar.
Yeah, it's been going on for 4 years now. This is the warmest one to date. How was the ice last night?
Well, I talked to a lot of the players afterwards, and I think surprisingly, perhaps, the ice wasn't all that bad. The puck didn't stick, which Washington coach Bruce Boudreau said he thought was going to be a real issue. It didn't. The puck did bounce a lot more. You had two of the game's top skilled teams on the ice, and you didn't see a lot of that skill on display because of the rain and the puck bouncing. So you didn't see the kind of dramatic skill set that you might otherwise have seen. But you did see a lot of shots on goal and a lot of action. And so, you know, if your glass is half full, it was still a pretty compelling game.
So the NHL actually chooses the teams to play. So what was special about this matchup between the Penguins and the Capitals, other than, you know, like distance on the turnpike?
Well, I mean, you have a natural rivalry between, I think, two of the games. Most dynamic players, Sidney Crosby having a season for the ages, a season that is putting a lot of people in mind of Wayne Gretzky or Mario Lemieux at their prime. He's running away with the NHL scoring title. Alexander Ovechkin, not as dramatic this year points-wise, but he is, and since the end of the lockout, has been the game's, I think, single most dynamic player, the way he plays, his personality. And the two have a natural rivalry. They don't particularly like each other. The Penguins defeated Washington in the playoffs en route to a Stanley Cup in 2009, in I think maybe one of the most compelling playoff series in recent memory. So there is a natural rivalry. And then to take it all to a stage where 68,111 people are sitting in the rain on New Year's Day to watch them compete, I think this... Yeah, this probably was as good a matchup as there's been in the Winter Classic four-year history.
Scott Burnside covers hockey for ESPN.com, and we reached him in Pittsburgh. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Anytime.
Philosophy professor Michael Tabor thinks we use ethical reasoning all the time in our daily lives, what we eat, what we buy, how we act toward other people. So he posed a challenge to the students in his class on altruism and egoism at St. Mary's College in Maryland. Decide, as a class, if he should donate his own kidney to someone in need. Michael Tabor is with us now from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Good day.
Well, quite the question. It made me sort of grab for my side. How did you decide to put your kidney on the line for the sake of philosophy?
I was trying to come up with an exercise that would allow them to apply some of the concepts and some of the discussions that we were having in the seminar to a real issue, and not just to a theoretical issue, but to a real issue. So I tasked them as one of the assignments over the course of the semester to write me some recommendations about whether or not I should donate a kidney to a stranger.
And the truth is, you expected them to say what?
I would have predicted that they would have recommended in favor of donation, but maybe have backed off and framed their recommendation with some caveats about, well, of course, it's your decision, or we realize it's a difficult issue, so we don't expect you necessarily to take our advice. And I had told them at the beginning of the semester that I did reserve the right to not take whatever their recommendation would be.
Which was?
Their recommendation was not to donate. Although it wasn't because they thought it was a bad idea. It wasn't because they thought that donating was not a good thing. In fact, many of them, through the recommendation paper, it was very clear that they believed that this was would be a very good thing to do, going above and beyond in all the usual sorts of ways we would talk about such charitable actions. But they felt uneasy making that recommendation to someone they know, namely me.
How did you feel about your students' response? How did you assess them?
Well, when I first read the paper, I was quite impressed with the rather extensive discussion they had and the way that they had carved up the issues. In terms of assessment, the students got an A. I told them that they would all get the same grade for it. It was worth 5% of the grade, and they got full 5% for the paper.
So you weren't disappointed.
I was very impressed with the paper upon first reading, and then I actually had a bit of pause the second time reading through it, which was actually the next morning, which is where I was more struck with how it was that they were not making a recommendation. They were deliberately backing off, in some sense, what they were assigned to do. But
they saw it as responsibility, not advice.
They saw it as responsibility, and I think in part that's because there is something much more personal and intimate about envisioning someone lying on an operating table and being cut open. The decision to do something as intimate and personal as giving literally a part of oneself is not simply like whether or not to donate, even a sizable amount of money to a good cause.
But you're teaching philosophy, not precisely medical ethics. And the kids said, listen, we know that this is going to look at first glance like a cop-out. I'm looking at their paper right here.
Right.
They said none of us could handle the decision of being responsible for the choice if something went wrong. Is that a cop-out?
I guess it is a cop-out in the sense that there's all kinds of ways that we can rationalize to ourselves not getting involved. Even though, I must say, I did tell them in class the day after I read the paper, I said, look, if I were trying to decide between buying an SUV and a small hybrid, I'm sure none of you would have had any reluctance about giving me recommendations.
Well, let me jump in there. This is a class, altruism and egoism. Was there an element of egoism involving yourself and in posing this question in the first place, whether you should donate your kidney?
That is actually one of the issues we did talk about. By the virtue of making this public, does that detract from the altruism of the action? That's an issue, and that's an issue I wanted them to address, and they did address.
So, Michael Tabor, what happens to your kidney now?
What I am going to do is still donate. I would like to wait maybe 8 to 10 years until our daughters are in a more kind of stable, I hope by then, stable life situation. And I, being 51 now, shouldn't be too decrepit that no one would want my kidney.
That's Michael Tabor, a philosophy professor at St. Mary's College, Maryland. He asked his students to craft an argument about whether or not he should donate his own kidney. Michael Tabor, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. It's enjoyable talking to you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Over the years, if we were lucky, we received good advice from people of older generations. Sometimes, however, that advice doesn't stick. I'm not talking about the big life issues. I mean the little things, how to change the oil in your car, how to shake hands properly, or how to sew a button. In 2009, Erin Breed published a book with advice about things your grandmother knew. Her new book is called How to Build a Fire and Other Handy Things Your Grandfather Knew. Erin Breed is in our New York studio. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
There seems to be a lot of great advice on how to be thrifty. Was that a common thread among these grandfathers?
Absolutely. They were all born before 1927, so they all lived through the Great Depression. And I heard a lot of stories about being resourceful and making do. One of the grandfathers I talked to was Joe Toth, who was an electrician in Pennsylvania. He was born outside of Buffalo, New York, and he had 11 siblings. He used to wear knickers, as did all the boys at the time, and they had these elastic bands or, you know, bands under their knees. He would do his part to help his family by walking around the neighborhood and looking for fruit trees, and he would climb these trees, and he would fill his pockets, and because they were holy, his entire knickers with fruit, and he would waddle home with his entire pants full of fruit. And that's what he did as a young boy to help feed his family. But I think those lessons about being thrifty and being resourceful stayed with them from childhood throughout their lives.
The ability to change a tire is invaluable information. So it only follows, I should ask you, how many tires have you successfully changed on your own?
I'm happy to say I have changed 3 tires to date, and thankfully not all at the same time.
Huh? And did you get the advice from these gentlemen?
Well, it's easier now that I have this advice from them, but because I've interviewed grandfathers as the source of this book, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, this is a great book for boys. This is a great book for men. And I heard the same thing about the grandmother book, How to Sew a Button. This is great for girls and great for women. Man or woman, everybody should know how to change a tire or cook their own dinner. It does not discriminate.
Did you actually ask these men how to write a love letter? I mean, did they did they blush, or did they volunteer information readily?
I heard the sweetest love stories talking to these guys. And the one that I always think of is, again, from Joe Toth. And he met his wife before he shipped off to the war. And she was actually dating his best friend. And he told his friend, if you screw up with Frances, she's mine. And his friend did screw up. And then he shipped out to the Pacific and spent a few years on a boat. And he stayed in touch with her by writing love letters the whole time. And he told me he would look through a big book of quotations and he'd find inspiration. And then he'd sort of riff off of this singular quote that he found. And he said he thinks he really won her heart because he addressed every letter, Dear Mush, and he signed everyone, Loves Ya, Your JoJo.
I personally don't need this piece of advice, but how does one properly wax a mustache?
You know, I have to say there are 2 tips in the book that are for men only, and that's how to wax a mustache and how to grow a beard. And I have not personally tried either of those, I'm happy to report.
Do you remember the advice, though?
Sure. You just, you know, you get a wax that matches the color of your mustache, and you get, there's a tiny little mustache brush, and you just brush it in and work the wax to the side, and then you can sculpt the ends however you'd like. You know, you can do the Salvador Dali whoosh or the, you know, the Snidely Whiplash curl. You can get really artsy with that.
At the beginning of your book, you say you only knew one of your grandfathers. Mm-hmm. What's the best piece of advice you learned from him?
Well, you know, I have 2 great memories of my grandfather, and one is he used to let me shine his bald head with a rag, which I got such a kick out of. And he also taught me to play the guitar. And I still have the guitar that he loaned to me. And he passed away a few years ago, but I still have that guitar. I still play it. And I still wonder what else I could have learned from him if only I'd asked. And that's an important lesson I took away from the book. It's that a lot of people of my generation, you know, we think we're too smart to ask our grandparents these questions, or we think, you know, they're just old, we must know better. But if we don't sit down and ask these questions of our grandparents, these stories will be lost forever. Actually, Bill Holloman, one of the gentlemen I interviewed for the book,
who was a Tuskegee Airman, I'll point out.
That's right. He was the first black helicopter pilot in the Air Force. He passed away a few weeks after our last interview. And I just feel so honored and privileged that I had the chance to ask him these stories that even his children had never heard. He was a Red Tail, which meant he piloted the planes that escorted bombers on missions. And he said when he got there, he sent Hitler a telegram and told him he was coming for him. And I said, well, did Hitler ever write you back? And he said, he didn't write me back, but he listened and then he quit.
Great story.
Yeah.
I should point out this isn't just a how-to book, you know, step one, step two, step three. It's all about living. Are you taking a particular piece of advice from your interviews with these gentlemen to heart and putting into practice?
Yeah. One of the common threads I noticed in all the grandfathers is when I called many of them out of the blue, and some of them I had introductions to through their children or grandchildren. I called them and I said, I need your help. And without hesitation, every single one of them said, what do you need? And this reminds me of a story I heard from Bill Holloman. He grew up in St. Louis, and he said his family wasn't flush during the Depression. His father was a postal carrier. His mom stayed at home. He had a few siblings. And his mom always set 3 extra plates at dinner. And in case he had, you know, he ran across any kids who were hungry at the ball field or whatever, who wanted to come home and needed a meal. And I think when I think about what all these grandfathers had in common and what makes this so-called greatest generation so great, is that when times were hard, they pulled together. And now when we're faced with hard times, we have that same choice. We can either come together or fall apart. And I think, you know, what I learned from them is the way I want to live my life. I want to come together. I want to answer the call. I want to help out where I can.
Erin Breed is the author of How to Build a Fire and Other Handy Things Your Grandfather Knew. She's also a senior staff writer at Self Magazine, and she joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have a piece of advice that you would like to share with us, visit the NPR Weekend Edition Facebook page. The news media have done more than their share of navel-gazing throughout the years, but 2010 was particularly rich for self-scrutiny. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is in New York. He's covered the coverage in 2010. Happy New Year, David.
Happy New Year, Leanne.
There were individual stories, the Stewart-Colbert rally, say, the WikiLeaks, I mean, different news stories that all had value individually. But if you put all of these stories in a cauldron, would you see some common ingredients?
I guess the one thread that I've been trying to tease out through the year involves the question of trust, or another way to describe it is authoritativeness. That is, where do people trust to turn to get the news? Where do they look to and say, that's information that I find useful and that's information that I believe in? And I think we're seeing some transitions in how people define that.
Let's start with a big story, the WikiLeaks document dump. This really tested the bounds of what you call authoritativeness or trust. What were the issues at stake?
There are some competing interests at stake. WikiLeaks, of course, has obtained a treasure trove of many hundreds of thousands of documents, official cables that have been classified to varying degrees of secrecy. Earlier in the year, questions of videotape of American attack in Iraq several years ago, now question of diplomatic cables being published more recently. And the question is, who controls this information? Is it the government that creates and classifies this information, or a website that says, hey, we can post it, and in this case, we can do it in concert with a number of very distinguished news organizations throughout the globe. Julian Assange, the leader of WikiLeaks, actually spoke with our colleague Robert Siegel earlier this year. Here's how he described the usefulness of the documents they obtain.
These raw facts can be interpreted by others who are trying to propose alternative policies, by academics, by journalists, and by the people concerned with the war directly, soldiers and the Afghanis.
And Assange describes himself as the editor-in-chief, and that is, of course, a journalistic title. But people question, is he a journalist? Is he a source? Is he a conduit? He obviously himself does have an agenda politically in the sense that he's very much against American military action abroad.
Several journalists actually made news in 2010 after being fired or disciplined for personal statements. Here's just a clip of some of the voices you may recognize.
I'm telling you that everybody who runs CNN is a lot like Stewart. And a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart. And to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority? Yeah.
I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know, the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
Any comments on Israel? We're asking everybody today. Any comments on Israel?
Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine.
That's longtime White House correspondent Helen Thomas, preceded by Juan Williams, whose comments on Fox led to his dismissal from NPR. And we began with Rick Sanchez on CNN. David Folkenflik, their dismissals raised a lot of questions about how journalists should behave. Have the rules changed? And if they have, why?
Well, the rules may not have quite have changed, but expectations are evolving, and the nature of news organizations themselves are evolving. So, you know, you have somebody like Juan Williams, our former colleague here at NPR, which sees itself as a straight-ahead news organization. Williams was operating in a climate that rewards strongly held opinion and personal assertion over at Fox News and on cable. Rick Sanchez, CNN, says, you know, we're straight-ahead, despite having critics from various sides. It says, you know, we can't be in the position of having our anchors create such controversy with statements that seem to us beyond the pale. Helen Thomas, you know, was a columnist, an opinion journalist by this point for Hearst newspapers after many decades as a wire service reporter. Her comments were seen as very much beyond the pale as well.
Jon Stewart also continued to make news. I mean, he calls The Daily Show fake news, but he made news. For the way he satirically covered the news media, But when he was involved in the push to get the Senate to act on health benefits for 9/11 first responders, there was absolutely no mockery involved. Let's hear what he said.
This bill would provide $7 billion in medical and financial benefits for Ground Zero workers who get sick, and they're going to pay for it by closing a corporate tax loophole. It's a win-win-win-win. Just do it!
David Folkenflik, do you think the mandate from John Stewart's viewers has changed? I mean, do they expect him to take action now rather than just entertain them?
I think it's really about what John Stewart sees his role as in this kind of news culture and ecosystem. He says, look, I'm not a journalist, but he certainly does some rather serious interviews or interviews that get at serious points with newsmakers and consequential figures. When he took this job over from Craig Kilborn, he said, I want to do satire with a point. And I think you saw that with that so-called rally to restore sanity that he did with Stephen Colbert on the Washington Mall. They had a point to make, and they were talking about the hyper-heated rhetoric that we have that they both feel gets in the way of constructive political ends. He is willing to do satire with a point, and when no one else is paying attention, he's willing to make it quite pointed indeed.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thanks a lot, David.
You bet.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
For most of us, tonight marks the end of weeks of holiday feasting. If you still have an appetite, it's not too late to defy the fates and eat your way to a lucky new year. Our guide to foods lucky and not so lucky?
I'm Tanya Steele, editor-in-chief of Epicurious.com.
Now, in the South, starting off the year with a dish of black-eyed peas is a good luck tradition. How this got started is a subject of debate, but Steele has a favorite story.
During the Civil War in Vicksburg, Mississippi, the townspeople thought they'd run out of every possible morsel of food. So they were searching and searching, and they found some dried black-eyed peas, and that kind of saved the town.
In Germany, eating pork is considered lucky for the new year. The German phrase for I've been lucky, ich habe Schwein gehabt, is the same as I've had a pig.
Pigs are kind of rooted in the ground and they're always moving forward, so they symbolize progress. And they have a very rich fat content, which really signifies kind of prosperity.
On the other side of the barnyard, Hungarians avoid eating chicken or other fowl that scratch the ground for food for fear that they would also scratch away good luck. Steele raises another reason why birds might be a bad New Year's choice.
So anything winged apparently is not good luck because that good luck could fly away from your house, so you don't want to do that.
And Steele's family has a personal dining aversion at the beginning of the new year.
We've never eaten lobster on New Year's because it is considered bad luck, merely because they move backwards and could apparently lead to setbacks in the new year.
If you're looking for something lucky and something sweeter, there's a tradition that dates back to 1909, when farmers in the Spanish city of Alicante were faced with a surplus of grapes. With each of the 12 strokes of midnight on New Year's Day, revelers eat a grape, one for each month of the new year.
The theory is that, say, one goes down badly, or the fifth one is sour, or the sixth one is going rotten, then that particular month is not going to be good.
Round or ring-shaped cakes and other baked goods may not lead to good health, but in Mexico or Greece, coin-like shapes are thought to ensure a prosperous year. Cakes there are baked with coins and other surprises are hidden inside. The lucky finders get a year of good fortune, as long as their dental work holds up. And then there's Steele's favorite lucky food for the new year.
Pecan shortbread cookies, which are just a staple in our household. They are so delicious, and they bring good luck because we love to eat them. So the only thing that we have to worry about post-New Year's is all of the foods that we've eaten to bring us good luck, in fact, brought us kind of extra pounds.
A perennial challenge just about everybody faces after the holidays. This year, though, maybe luck will be on our side.